From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So what didn't federal officials know? And when didn't they know it?
It was just yesterday that President Trump said no one had even heard of the virus 2 months ago, but we are now learning that as far back as late November, American military medical investigators overseas sounded the alarm to officials right here at home about a contagion that was sweeping through Wuhan.
So we were alerted by some discussions that Dr. Redfield, the director of the CDC, had with Chinese colleagues on January 3rd. It's since been known that there may have been cases in December, not that we were alerted in December.
Speaking last month, that was Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, who, according to the Washington Post, couldn't or didn't discuss the matter with the president until 2 weeks after he was alerted about the virus on January 18th, when, by the way, Trump quickly changed the subject to the availability of flavored vaping products. A week and a half after that, reported the New York Times, White House advisor Peter Navarro circulated a memo warning top administration officials of the very calamity that has since befallen us, as had the intelligence agencies throughout January and February. Not to be outdone, The Onion reported Wednesday on a damning report that, quote, White House officials failed to heed repeated warnings of impending doom that arrived via four skeletal horsemen galloping through the sky. So, no, the federal government did not succeed in preparing for the calamity, and it's not so hot at documenting it now. Instead, non-governmental third parties have stepped into the gap. Outlets like The Post and The Times, as well as educational institutions like Johns Hopkins and the University of Washington, have translated dizzying national data into powerful visualizations and projections. And then there's the COVID Tracking Project, which is collecting data and lots of it. This ad hoc bunch of journalists, researchers, and programmers is not just aggregating, but thoroughly explaining local and state-level info, and is among the most highly regarded of such collectors. Last month, its managing editor, Aaron Kassane, told CJR, "Every day we hope the CDC will put us out of business." But the project's leader, Atlantic staff writer Alexis Madrigal, whom we caught up with in the middle of an animated homeschooling lesson, said the federal agencies still haven't come through.
You know, we really, really, really were expecting that they would come out with these kinds of numbers, you know, state-by-state numbers, testing numbers, outcomes, and instead the exact opposite has happened. There is no information that has come out, and we have ended up basically having to set up this project to go for as long as the outbreak goes. So we're kind of in the process of trying to figure that out. Because if you're doing something for a few weeks, you need a different kind of system than if you're doing something for, you know, 12 to 18 months.
Now, this is clearly the kind of data set that we expect from government. Are the data being suppressed? Are there just no resources at the relevant agencies because of budget cuts or whatever? How can it be that it has fallen to a third party to aggregate and distribute just basic public health information?
Oh, man, we've asked ourselves this question a lot of times. And I think there's a few different answers. You know, our system is federalized in this crucial way, and the public health departments are just so different state to state in how they run, how well resourced they are. Two states that have had tremendous success testing, Utah and New Mexico, I mean, not perfect, but they've just been able to test a lot of people, each have this kind of lab that's close by that did all the testing for them. So at every level, this variability in the way that this data is generated, the thing that's been confusing is just that there isn't a governmental body that's come in and just said, hey, listen, report this information at this time, and we'll put out this report each day at this time. That is the part that is stunning to me. And in a really direct answer to your question, is information being suppressed? We haven't been able to find evidence of that yet, but I don't think it can be totally explained by just the bureaucratic difficulties, because it bears such a similarity to other types of reporting that the CDC does do, like around influenza.
Yeah, I don't ask for no reason. You know, we are aware that, for example, through legislation, government agencies like the Justice Department aren't allowed to track certain aspects of gun violence because it is deemed potential propaganda for the anti-gun lobby. Nothing as nefarious as that going on, is there?
Not that we've been able to see. I think it's more what people know, because a lot of it is uncertain. But it's also sort of the institutional constraints that are imposed on them. And I do not think that there is a maximal transparency ethos in any part of the system that we're talking about here, whether that's the federal government or the largely private entities that we're relying on to do this national response. And I think that it reveals, just like so many other things with this outbreak, the nature of our information ecosystem is largely dependent on people who do not actually have civic-minded transparency built into the core of what they do.
Now, your project isn't just a compilation of public health data. It's also a scorecard. You are evaluating the data as you go. Have any of the states whom you've graded poorly boosted their grades since you began reporting?
Yeah. The people who I really think drive this change are the local reporters at local newspapers, at local radio stations, investigative people at Fox affiliates, you know, I mean, all over the place. While their institutions collapse around them, they are still going to government officials asking for this data and forcing it out of places. And I think that we just need to recognize that. I think what our project allows those people to do, and pro-transparency state legislators and governors to do, is to say to private testing companies and whoever else, listen, if that state can get that data, then we should also have that data. We were able to show very early on that there was this huge variability in how states were reporting tests. You know, the first thing was, okay, we're just reporting positives. Then we were able to, you know, I'm talking about journalism collectively and pro-transparency forces generally, we're able to get, okay, negatives for the state lab. So now you can have a ratio. And then finally, we were able to get negatives from all the commercial laboratories as well. And that's really important because one way of understanding this outbreak is just looking at the positive cases. The other way of looking at it that's also important is how many people have we tested overall? One really just stark example of this is in New Jersey, 45% of the tests that are going in are coming back positive in New Jersey. And that tells you something about the known unknown number of cases that are out there. There must be a huge number of people who are infected in New Jersey that haven't been tested, because such a high percentage of positives means that the testing criteria are pretty tight. You look at Washington State, for example, you know, their positive rate all in is something more like 8% or so. That's pretty different from 45%, and it tells you that their outbreak is in a much different place, even though the raw numbers don't fully tell that story.
Well, as you just alluded to, we know that the number of infections must exceed the number of official cases, perhaps by an order of magnitude, because so few have been tested.
I agree with that.
But even the mortality numbers could be skewed. Tuesday of this week, my colleagues at Gothamist reported that the number of at-home deaths in New York, people who weren't diagnosed with COVID and probably never will be, it's something like 10 times what it usually is. 200 New Yorkers dying at home every day compared to the norm of something between 20 and 25. Don't these factors on either side make all of the aggregated data suspect? I mean, garbage in, garbage out?
I'm not sure it's garbage, but there's a lot of noise in the signal. These numbers are the best we've got, but they require an enormous amount of qualitative description, caveating, and understanding that you just can't expect that the results will fully describe the situation. Because the testing regimes and the testing reporting has been spotty, people have started to use deaths as the most reliable proxy for the severity of an outbreak. Now, there's crosswinds, though. One of them you mentioned, which is that there are probably other deaths that are going on that we're not able to capture. That's actually just a part and parcel of what it is to be in a disaster scenario.
Such as in Puerto Rico.
Exactly. So in Puerto Rico, or in any of these kind of situations where you have a major natural disaster, way after the fact, people get all these all-in mortality numbers, and then they're able to compare, well, how many people died during that time versus how many people would we have expected to die? And then that gap is the real sort of effect of that event. that's a complicated thing to do, but it's a possible thing to do. And we'll eventually end up doing it with the coronavirus outbreak as well. And we'll probably learn a lot more than we can, you know, here in the fog of pandemic. I do want to note that on deaths, there's another piece of it, though, that it kind of cuts in the opposite direction, which is, you know, a lot of the people who are dying are older and they have other conditions. And the way that a governmental body attributes the death to COVID-19 instead of something else is also another variable. That is going to be really, really tricky as we go forward to try and tease out really the decisions that went into generating these statistics and then try to do some meta-analysis that allows us to say these ones turned out to be more reliable or seem more reliable and these ones did not.
One of the new storylines this week's new has been the hardly surprising lessons learned from the new demographic data from places like Milwaukee and Chicago. Contrary to what may have been said regarding coronavirus as the great equalizer, there is a stark racial disparity in hospitalizations and in deaths. Because, as in every other aspect of our society, some people turn out to be more equal than others. Are you overlaying such demographic data on your results?
We're working on spinning up the capture of this data with a couple of other groups, including, you know, one of my Atlantic colleagues, Ibram Kendi, who's been calling for this information to be recorded. Honestly, we hadn't seen it until just about the past 5 days or so. I think we're up to 10 states now report some version of this. When you see racial data that is largely coming from one city in which Black people tend to be overrepresented because of the long history of racist urbanization, you are going to see high rates of infections and deaths among Black people. Take New Orleans, for example. And the state of Louisiana is going to have relatively fewer Black people in it. So you want to make sure that when you're looking at these numbers, you're actually comparing what's the demographic baseline of a place and what is also over and above systemic racism. I think there's absolutely every reason to expect that we're going to see the racial health disparities that are reflected throughout American society reflected here and probably amplified. I think if you look at some of the reporting that's coming out of the South right now, people who were already experiencing environmental racism, which is to say they're exposed to more pollutants, are having major health problems as a result of COVID-19. And that makes sense because of the fact that this thing has started out in cities, because of the nature of anti-Blackness, like within both the overall environment as well as within the healthcare system, and there's tons of studies on that in sociology of medicine. Because of all those factors, we need to talk about this for really what it is. This is really going to be about Black people in America and the systems that underserve those communities.
Alexis, thank you very much. I think you'll probably have to go corral your children right now.
Yes, I don't know if you can hear them in the background, but they're there.
Alexis Madrigal is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a leader of the COVID Tracking Project.
Coming up, the supply chain is less a chain than a puzzle box, hence toilet paper.
This is On the Media.